Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi from Brand Positive, a research, foresight, and strategy consultancy for corporates, agencies, and NGOs. I've spent 20 years working on catalytic projects around the world, and along the way have been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom are guests in this series, along with an array of other fascinating individuals. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, focused on innovation. My next book will focus on foresight. So, I hope you enjoy this podcast, which is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, a global leader in applying futures thinking to solve strategic challenges within organisations. But now, let me introduce today's guest. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by the dynamic Tom Morton, Global Chief Strategy Officer at RGA, who helps businesses and brands to win in the connected world by articulating a powerful strategic direction and organizing their actions and their people around it. He works intersectionally across the disciplines of brand strategy, marketing, design, communications, media, and experience. Tom specializes in working with brands at the forefront of technology and culture, including Amazon, ESPN, the Museum of Modern Art, PwC, Samsung, Vans, Verizon, Virgin, and Uber, and numerous others. As a thought leader, he's been a keynote speaker for the Cannes Lion, Web Summit, ANA, the 4As, the IAB, and Wharton Business School, and has created IP that attracts new business revenue and puts agencies on the biggest stages in the marketing world. But every colossus has to start somewhere, Tom. And so go on then. What was it like sending faxes when you were at Square Mile Communications back in the day?
It was, everyone's got to start. I think almost every first job, we forget this, most first jobs teach you how to have a first job. And yes, I send a great deal of faxes to city editors of British newspapers in the 90s who were kind enough to ignore most of them.
I was going to say, were you an efficient fax sender?
I was tolerable, I think. I was okay. But yes, I didn't start in, say, the creative strategy business. I started off as a PR person for a year. And I think it's always a lesson when you try a job and discover it's really not you. So it is probably best for the worlds of creativity and strategy and PR that I was rescued when I was and switched lane when I did.
Well, rescued as you were, and now obviously just had such an interesting career and obviously sort of a bit of a industry spokesperson, to put it mildly. I mean, leaping right up to today, because obviously there's a ton to talk about, all of it no doubt is going to be absolutely fascinating. I mean, obviously the biggest thing perhaps in agency land, if we can put it that bluntly, or brand land, of the last couple of months, I suppose, really was the Cannes Lion. And I think this year there seemed to be a lot of things going on there's a lot of shifting around going on in brand land, in agency land, etc. So I know it's a bit of a sort of a wide scope of a question, but go on then, Tom, what's going on?
Well, I think the Cannes Lion is always a symbol. It's almost like a biopsy of a moment in time about where is the power, where is the direction of the industry. Mm. And the fact that is always there is that agencies who create things are, you know, have a kind of decorative role. The real the power and most people who are present there are either marketers who are there to do business and genuinely improve their game. Or it's the platform owners. It is largely a festival of media and martech, because that is where that is the single biggest investment that most companies are making now.
Mm.
Yeah, if you look at, and it's always fascinating. We check in very frequently with our friends at Forrester and Gartner to get a proper, quantified C-suite perspective about where the business is going. And the truth is, you know, more than half of of marketing budgets go into technology stacks, and they go into paid media, and the rest being the salaries and operating costs of the marketing departments and agency fees. But it's Cannes is a reflection of where the dollars are going.
Mm. And in terms of where the dollars are going, I think it's really interesting. Let's say just one of the points that seemed to come out of it was, and perhaps as mentioned, the this appalling word only once, purpose. I mean, but actually, just prior to COVID, I interviewed you for my last book, and on that, and I'm quoting you back at you now. So it says here, so, you know, I went to Tom Morton from one of the industry's leading agencies, RGA, the leading agency, RGA. He told me that purpose was in danger of becoming a cliche at the Cannes line. We saw so many branded crusades on behalf of borrowed causes. Ouch. So just a bit on that, where are we now in terms of purpose? Because I think certainly one of the quotes seemed to come out of, I think, P&G, who said, now it's all about performance, not advocacy.
Well, I think what we're seeing is a swing of the pendulum. And where we're seeing purpose being useful and valuable in two places. The first is where brands are working out genuinely where there is an opportunity to do good, where there is like a mutual interest. Mm. And actually, taking one of our own clients, Procter & Gamble, mm-hmm. who have been very interested in what you need to really like the customers you need to advocate for, the relationships that you might need to build, and discover that actually for the corporate brand, having some kind of socially positive activity was very important. And we did some work with them last year around addressing anti-Asian discrimination. And you know, why is a manufacturer of soap and soap and diapers in that field? The answer is because they really care about households and making sure that families are okay. And one of the big things that we discovered working with them on it is that you don't have to make a choice necessarily between the good and the growth, because it turns out that activity, as well as like creating empathy at scale, does often have a payback in like greater positivity that people feel towards the brands. There is some enlightened self-interest in there. So I think understanding, as I say, not necessarily those kind of borrowed causes and crusades, but actually advocating around issues that are close to the heart of your brand and your customer, where you can make a difference. So I think there's some smart purpose things there. The other one is really what we mean by purpose, because purpose. I think purpose has been more or less, it's come to mean cause marketing.
Yep.
And the real meaning of a purpose is, look, what is the positive impact that your brand wants to have in the world? What is the thing your brand is trying to influence and is working towards? Yep. And that's actually something that's very close to the heart of a business. And like a real understanding of like, well, what are you here on this earth to do is actually incredibly relevant right now. And especially because when you think about how brands are expressing themselves and how they're coming to life, really the first encounters you have as a brand, it's with its products, with its interfaces, with its touch screens rather than its ad screens. Yep. And so purpose there as a real like organizational guide and a guide and a mandate to brand owners, like what's the next thing you should make? How should this customer experience flow? That's actually incredibly useful. And I think from our point of view as a company, because our revenue, our client work is split roughly evenly between customer experiences, products and services, and then campaigns and media type work. Yeah. Finding that actually a good purpose can be an absolute guide to your innovation, your customer experience. And so I think we're seeing we're at least in the client world we're seeing more of that, and I think really that's what's going to save purposes. It's not It's not how is your brand saving the world? Please make a TV spot about it. It's what the positive impact your brand hopes to have with its customers. Now, please design a product around it.
Such an interesting perspective. And another one, I just lob a couple of sort of quotes at you also from Kanter. This one really sort of grabbed my attention from Tor Myhren, probably pronouncing his name appallingly badly, the VP marketing at Apple, who said, "The agency's role now is as outside agitators whose value lies in challenging clients to see things from a fresh perspective." That's a nice old quote there.
I think there might be some truth in it, because we have to be honest, Apple is an extraordinary brand, and Apple also has an extraordinary agency relationship with Media Arts Lab and with its own growing business and its own internal communications organization, which at risk of plugging RGA, seems to be staffed largely by former RGAers. And I know elsewhere Apple have said, The role for internal marketing is to say why us, and the role for an external agency is why us, why now. So that intersection between what's the product and how do we make it culturally relevant. I think there's some truth in it. I think part of our job, because we start often with the customer, and we start with the world that we're working in. We get to bring that brings us more of an outside perspective. And the job of marketing has always been about that intersection. The quote, I guess, to like knock the tennis ball back across the net at Tor, is from Andy Burns at Google, who came up with the formula of know the user, know the magic, connect the two. And if you have that knowledge of the user and the user's world, you can find better, more meaningful ways of doing it. So one of the things that an external agency will never let go of is its ability to bring in a perspective about the customer, and especially like the next generation customer and the overlooked customer and the rising trend. That's still something that's extremely hard to grow internally in an organization which will be structured around product lines. It's almost like you have to take it on as an external thing.
How interesting. And also just moving on to, and I think another really, really fascinating point I'd really like to get into, and this is something that grabbed my eye. It was a piece that you put out recently that basically sort of took over LinkedIn. Meanwhile, so reading in Campaign, your point about building your brand as an operating system, something that you put out alongside your colleague Tiff Rolf. Perhaps just talk us through that. And also, I have to say, you had that great Chris Anderson from Wired quote about, you mentioned that he freaked out ad agencies when he told them that a brand is only what Google search says it is. Fantastic. But go on then, brands as operating systems, such an interesting perspective and standpoint. So go on then, Tom, what's that all about?
Yeah, let's explore that. And I'm going to take a step back for a second, because while it's an article that we published and it's an expression of a philosophy and a view of the world that we've been working with for some years, it's worth saying that there's been this, I would say, at least like a decade-long movement in amongst brand owners and amongst designers that recognizes, let's say, the systematic importance of brands, that really recognize that as the world became more digital, that brands, historic brand design saw the world in terms of like lines and logos and color schemes, and if you like, things that were designed for advertising and static media. And as the world digitized, and as a customer experience and advertising and products moved into a largely digital realm, a real growth of understanding that the brand you're designing, the brand you're building, actually needs to come to life first through interface and through innovation. Mm-hmm. And that's a movement that's existed for some time. We can look at like the pioneers in the field like Mark Shillam, who was the original brand designer at RGA more than a decade ago, who he used to speak about brands as patterns. And I know other people have written and podcasted using the operating system or the OS phrase. What it really speaks to is this, I guess, this seismic shift, which is that if you're building a brand now, you are building something that is a digital entity, because we are now 3 or 4 years into a world where the majority of advertising is digital, the majority of products and services are digitized, the majority of customer interactions are digital. And you're also building something that is probably like a shared entity. So something that is going to be built by a whole bunch of internal and external people, partnerships, agency partners, collaborators. And so actually what you need is, you need to, if you're going to build a brand, you need some kind of fundamental grounding that you can do it with, that other people can run with and build on and build applications for. And the analogy for that, at least in the computer science analogy for that, is an operating system. So the underlying program that allows you to build other things that go well together. Now, that's an analogy. I know we were using our, funny enough, it's actually, it's like our producers and technology team at RGA were using with our Nike clients back in the late 2000s. Just an organization that didn't necessarily like to talk about the poetics of the brand could absolutely recognize that their brand had an operating system. You know, it had certain beliefs about how things worked, what it did in the world, how, frankly, like how you logged into it.
Yeah. You could then, yeah.
If you understood those really well, you could hand them to people who could then build more easily. Mm-hmm. And so we've been using brand operating systems as an analogy and a way of thinking about this. So it's not like a discovery of RGAs. This is how we talk about it internally. This is how we've been codifying it, and it's really useful for a world that is more driven by interactions and by touch screens and by products and membership than it is by advertising. And I think that there's a few ways that the brand operating system model tends to work. So back to what we were saying about purposes, it is meant to be guiding all functions. It's meant to be there to inspire the innovation, the customer experience. And so you don't necessarily need a fanciful statement about changing the world. You just need to be clear about what you're there for. Yeah. And this is something that we found. I'll give you a crazy example. We, as well as some of the famous brands like Nike and Google who we work with the National Bank of Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Kuwait is a rich country and a very young country, and winning the next generation is very important for Kuwaiti businesses. And we helped them to design and build and launch a new fully digitized bank for younger customers. And actually creating a purpose for the brand was really important, because it then became a touchstone of why this thing exists separately to your parent company, and what's the use you're trying to create for people, what's the value you're trying to create for people, and what should be inspiring the customer experience and the feature set. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, the purpose, which was actually all about the next generation of this country trying to make working on their collective progress, becomes a really good clue for how you design a product. So firstly, it needs to guide all functions. It needs to be it assumes that the brand is going to manifest itself in interfaces, and it's also, I think this is very important, it should be allowing others to build applications on it. There's a reason why literally, like technical elements like login screens and membership become really important, because you can go and build more applications on them. Mm. And you look at like most of them, a lot of the most successful brands in the world have built up as ecosystems. Yep. And you know, if you have a login, you can get into a whole world of products and services. And that would be true of, say, of Nike, of Amazon, of Apple. And none of those brands, when they started to move into the services realm, none of them had designed the full suite of products and services. Yep. It was going to be iterative. And so having elements that you can take and repurpose becomes really important, because you know, one service builds another service, begets another service, and then suddenly, after 5-10 years, you're sitting on a genuine ecosystem.
Yeah,
and it was created because the brand stood for the same thing, the logins worked the same way, the customer experience was similar enough.
Yeah,
that you could create this world. And again, that's why the operating system model kind of works. You take something like Android, Google's Android system, which is a literal operating system, probably the most used service in the world, 3.5 billion users a day. Hmm. And the reason it exists is because there's something like between 3 and 6 million qualified Android developers, and they all need to know what to do. And if you had a kind of top, if you had a system where nothing could be done without like a top to top meeting and approval, you would never have the jillions of applications that run on the operating system. And at a smaller, less planetary level than that, I think that's how today's brands need to work.
That's so interesting. I think, and that really links into, again, I think, naturally, again, quoting you back at you again, from that piece when you, again, having just mentioned the issue about iteration, and the fact that, you know, things need to be, and indeed are, constantly updated rather than being viewed as a sort of a finished work of art. Really, really fascinating when you're looking at it. You know, you talk about it not being just the work of a lone genius, and also calling into question all those things like sort of brand Bibles and brand pyramids that were always, you know, seem to be sort of set in stone by the global head of marketing or whatever, and then no one dared to question anything. You know, that was it. And yet now that perhaps isn't the case. A bit perhaps you mentioned earlier on about sort of philosophy and perhaps a sort of a Nietzschean view of what can one sort of dare to become, being a sort of an iterative work in progress.
I think it's a slightly less precious view of what your brand governance should be. Now, there's always going to be one shared purpose. You can't have a brand that has totally different meanings for every user. And you've got to have guardrails, because the alternative is anarchy. But a lot of how you're building a brand is you're trying to help other people build it the right way. And the reason you want to send out signals to people of this is how you do it. This is how you get on board and contribute in the right way. And I think in a world where it's easier to build than ever before, you sort of need a brand system that is going to be a little more sympathetic to the builders than it is to the approvers.
Can I say, on that exact point about sort of builders and people contributing, etc., just in terms of the sort of harsh reality, the day-to-day activity now in agencies like RGA, can you just talk a bit about that, about, you know, what are people actually doing? Like, what are the, not that people have them, but what are their sort of the names on cards? Because I think sort of generally speaking, agency world as a really sweeping statement has been accused for many years of being like almost behind client world, essentially, in terms of clients of you as being, you know, in many cases really forward looking, shifting things around, adapting quickly. Meanwhile, certainly classic ad agencies seem to be really constricted in terms of a very top down approach for what people did, you know, very narrow lines of report of sort of a of clarity about, you know, what a role actually involved, etc. So go on then, you know, what sort of people are coming into agencies like RGA now, and what are they getting up to?
Well, the biggest single group of people within RGA are people with design titles. And whether that is verbal designers who are inventing brands and the language that brands use, experienced designers or visual designers, there is that would be the biggest group who are coming in. And the reason people are coming in is they're coming to make something different. They're coming to collaborate with people who they might not work with in more siloed, normie companies, and to make things that they might not make in more siloed and normie companies. I think that's almost like a promise that we have to keep fulfilling, both like for our own reputation and for the, in order to make sure that we're still creating value for our customers, our clients. And so that promise of come and work with different people and make different things becomes super important. And while there has to be some kind of titling, what we find, at least here, is that both the intersections, the innovation and the insights tend to come out of intersections. Yep. And so what useful to have titles to know where people came from. The real art is actually how you smush people together and get them working together. So we found while titling becomes a way of like creating some kind of sanity in the organization, most of the magic comes from managing that mix.
Really nice. Moving to something completely different, should we say? We were talking earlier on. I really enjoyed you talking about. So it has to be how to kind of, I even sort of put this question out there. But go on then. From Aristotle to Wham. Come on then, Tom. Discuss.
From Aristotle to Wham. My goodness. Let's do this. I think the Netflix Wham documentary has been one of the sensations of the summer. We could talk about Barbie or Oppenheimer or the Women's World Cup, but I think in terms of nonfiction entertainment, there has been nothing like the Wham documentary. And there's something deeper in it. Part of the reason why it's been popular, it's deeper than nostalgia. It's profoundly nostalgic documentary. It's a really beautiful story about male friendship. It's the story of this beautiful, supporting, platonic friendship between George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley. And I know there's been a lot of focus on, as you watch the documentary, you think, well, actually, Andrew Ridgeley was one of the creative geniuses behind this band. And he allows his school friend, Yogg, to blossom into this superstar called George Michael and find his voice and eventually fly free as this world-beating solo artist who gets to like find his true identity. It's a story about male friendship. And at a time when almost all discussions about men are lensed through things like either it's like failing, gradually socially failing men, toxic masculinity, these bizarre masculine movements that have emerged online through folks like Andrew Tate and Jordan Peterson, there is actually an enormous and important space just for male friendship. And that, I guess, this is where we get back to Aristotle, the idea that actually the way that what is a good life is a life in which you thrive. And the important that you enable others to thrive. I think Terry Eagleton, who one of my favorite writers on like philosophy and culture.
Brilliant.
Eagleton defines love as creating for another a space in which they might flourish at the same time as they do it for you. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it's probably one of the best definitions of friendship as well. And I think that's really what we saw in the Wham documentary. I know a lot of people love Peter Jackson's Get Back documentary about the Beatles for a similar reason. It's actually it's a beautiful story about a group of friends who support each other and allow each other to flourish And so yeah, it becomes like a ready-made analogy for like how to create a creative culture. But it's an analogy about friendship. And we need to spend more time thinking about that. I guess I have this unusual perspective. I'm a British person, and I moved to America more than a decade ago. And so I have a lot of deep friendships that need to be renewed by coming back to the mother country and seeing people. But they're sustained by like WhatsApp groups and text threads. And I think that's probably the case for a lot of people. Yeah. Post COVID, our support groups, our friendship groups have actually become more codified because we're doing them through these social groups. And I think there's probably, if you spoke to most guys, they will tell you they're on a thread about, it doesn't matter. It could be music. It could be a hobby. It could be sport. It could be, you know, a group of old school friends or something. And that's holding lots of people together. There's this beautiful collection of webs of support that are happening out there and holding friendship groups together. And I think, you know, if we're looking at like, what does it mean to have, you know, what does male friendship mean? What does support look like now? You don't need a kind of weaponized charlatan like Andrew Tate or Jordan Peterson to tell you how to do it. You actually might just need George and Andrew.
Yeah. And
that's the journey, that wham to Aristotle and back again.
Exactly. And in terms of idea of sort of weaponized charlatans and the opposite end of that, really interesting thinking and activity now going on around the whole concept of fandom, which I know you're also into. And you mentioned things like the recent epic Women's World Cup. But go on then. So fandom, where is that now? What's that all about?
So this is a topic that's come up a lot at in my company, because a lot of our clients are sports brands, Nike, ESPN. We recently helped Dwayne Johnson to relaunch the XFL, the new American Football League, and we've been doing a lot of work with sports clubs. And again, I should say, fandom's a topic that's been written about a lot in the world of. In the world of gaming and in the world of pop music. And I know, you know, in the UK, Zoe Scammon has been a terrific and well-published writer about this space. We've been spending a lot of time just looking at sports fandom, because we have a bit of a principle in our company, which is that basically the work drives the philosophy. Mm-hmm. And the best way to discover a new subject is to like encounter it on a client project, realize it might be something bigger. And, you know, you've got to go and do a bit of a deep dive on it. Yep. And so we're spending a lot of time this year looking at what's happening to sports fandom. And I think that the story really starts with, I guess, a paradox or a challenge, which is that sport is, it seems almost certainly, and especially I've got to speak from an American perspective, because this is where I'm based and where a lot of our clients are. Sport is like the last force that still holds people together. If you look at the most viewed programs in the United States, more than 90% are sports broadcasts. Mm-hmm. And you think about, what are people still prepared to talk about? You look at the trending topics on Twitter. It will nearly always be a game or a fixture. And it's certainly like one of the remaining things that people are willing to spend money on. Mm-hmm. And so you have this incredible binding force. And yet at the same time, a lot of the traditional measures of avidity, of how many diehard fans there are in sports, are falling. Mm-hmm. And so we really wanted to try and understand that. And it's something that popped for us a few years ago, working with ESPN, talking about like the future of sports fandom. And I'm going back 6 or 7 years here. As an organization, they used to track avidity by the number of minutes people spent watching live games. And that is falling, falling, falling. But actual interest in sports, and the number of people who call themselves a sports fan, or, you know, talk about the subject, have it as part of their identity is extremely healthy. And I guess what we're seeing is that there is this break between fandom and minutes viewed. And so we decided to dig in and try and understand like what are the patterns of younger fans, and also difference between, say, self-defined casual and diehard fans. And the first thing we found was two-thirds of the viewing occasions we could identify of where people are watching some kind of sport, engaging sport content, are non-traditional, non-linear. So there is, like, at least like an American sport, if you close your eyes and think of American sports, it tends to be there's a bunch of people sitting on bleachers with their faces painted in the team colors going wild. Yeah. Or there is a dad in the basement rec room gesturing, on a lazy boy with a beer in his hand, gesturing and shouting at the screen while he watches a basketball or a baseball game that lasts for 2.5 hours nonstop. And that's not how most sport is being consumed. And the big pattern that we identified is when we ask people like how you became a fan, the pattern that we've been conditioned to expect, and we are both supporters of the same football team, we should disclose to the listeners.
Absolutely.
A lot of the expectations that are held about fandom is that it's tribal and it's inherited. Yeah, it's a thing you were born into. It is somehow part of your blood. Truth is, for a lot of fans now, for the majority of younger fans, it's not. It's something they chose. It's something they became interested in, and the way they're engaging with it is with the stories around what's happening around the court and off the pitch, mm-hmm. And it's really something, the fandom isn't something you defeat people with or you hold deep inside your body. It's something you share with people. And so we think about it as like on-demand fandom. And that as a pattern and legitimizing that. Maybe the most quotable person in the whole of the brand world is Cindy Gallup. And she always says there's a shit ton of money to be made from taking women seriously. And I think the analogy with that with sports and technologies, there is a ton of money being made by taking younger people seriously. And behaviors that you're seeing that are non-traditional. Let's not just make it generational. There is a shit ton of money to be made by taking next generation behavior seriously. Behaviors you're seeing are not the same as the traditions you grew up with doesn't mean they're not legitimate. And if you started to think that fans are on demand, and it's not like there's diehard face painters and dads shouting at screens and everyone else is somehow an arriviste or somehow second tier, then it unlocks everything. I think I see it a lot actually. Just watching the number of sports that are growing in the US, you watch the growth of soccer, of MLS, the growth of Formula One, the growth of combat sports, and you're watching whole new generations of people like finding new allegiances, being fascinated by the game around the game. The stories of Lionel Messi's arrival into Miami have been terrific, and a lot of the footage has been. It's been like people seeing him in supermarkets in Miami, or it's been like watching him and the Beckhams enjoying their next chapter of fame. And I think it's really representative of how fandom can build. And I was reading, and for the British audience, I was reading a great story about Sky Sports is about to start a football documentary, which is all about football culture, and a lot of it is based around like the social media banter and around the music, aimed at what do you do to service Gen Z fans? Because Sky Sports has been absolutely terrific at serving people who are watching games in games in pubs at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, but it can do so much more for Gen Z. And when I read that story, I thought this is taking non-traditional behavior seriously. This is recognizing the on-demand fan, treating them as legit, and there is so much future to be had there. Whether you're an established league or team that's trying to remain relevant, or you're a new team trying to find your feet, you've got to take those on-demand fans seriously.
Yeah. Fantastic, which is all obviously incredibly positive, as is another thing I just want to discuss with you in the time we have left. And so, you know, again, perhaps having moved from Wham to Aristotle, now let's go Henry. Go on then, Tom, what's that all about?
Yeah, let's talk about that. I've been thinking about the brands that are really impressing me in my life and my own encounters with them. I got two daughters. The oldest one is 9, and she's become increasingly self-conscious about pocket money. And mm-hmm. you know, it's a quantified thing, and you know, there is giving a kid like dollar bills every week is kind of strange in an increasingly cashless society. And GoHenry is a savings service for kids. It's a fintech, but it's a way of organizing pocket money. And you can earn money for chores. You can earn points for learning about money. It's extremely easy to move money in, and you can decide whether you want that money to go into your child's spending account or their saving account. And it's really beautiful to see a product that is basically designed around helping people achieve their goals and live their best lives.
Mm.
I know one of the best phrases that I've encountered this year in the world of like business and technology is Cory Doctorow's phrase. He talks about enshittification of the internet, yeah. which really he's talking about the digital products and platforms that achieve enormous scale, then reveal their nefarious intentions and gradually start treating their customers and suppliers worse and worse because there's no escape. And it's kind of beautiful. While he's got a particularly partisan point of view about what business looks like online, it's kind of beautiful to be dealing with a product that is designed entirely around people's best intentions. And so if anyone else fancies like contributing to Matilda's pocket money, I'm very happy. You can Venmo me later. But GoHenry is a terrific product to see. Just watching that positivity, watching a thing that is designed entirely to help someone live a better life, is really powerful.
Which does indeed take us right back to Aristotle and indeed to Plato. So meanwhile, just before we finish off, Tom, because it's been, as always, so great talking with you. Super interesting. Could happily been doing this forever, but I know you're a busy individual. So, but before we let you go on then. If you can talk about it, what's coming up in the short to medium term future in your life? Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on in my personal life? Back to school season is coming in New York in a couple of weeks. Watching the kids grow and become better writers and performers and find their thing. At work, it is all about finding out how we just continue to make truly valuable things out of new experiences and out of new technologies. We're coming into this age of abundance right now, whether that is the abundant creativity of generative AI, the abundant reach of media platforms, and working out how to make truly valuable things in it. And it's what keeps up that vitality. You know, Tor Myron talks about the external perspective, but really the perspective of like, in a world where anything is possible, what is truly valuable is still the question that should be, you know, keeping us awake and giving us a good reason to come in.
Well, what a superb way to end the conversation. Absolutely fascinating. We covered a lot of ground there, by the way. Tom, I thought it was fantastic. So took us through from Cannes through to what people actually get up to in agencies, through your perspectives around brands as operating systems, you know, really interesting takes on issues around sort of a fandom, male friendship, linking into everything from Wham through to virtuous behavior, and a nice opposite take to the sort of unpleasant world that is often out there in terms of where the internet has taken us. And so therefore Go Henry being the positive antidote to a lot of that. Absolutely fantastic. And meanwhile, along the way, managed to get in a big shout out to a lot of fantastic people like the mighty Cindy Gallup. So that just leaves me to say to Tom Morton, the Global Chief Strategy Officer, RGA, thank you very much indeed.
Sean, thank you for having me. Lovely talking with you.
Thanks for listening to The New Abnormal. This series is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, which helps clients become futures ready. Just so you know, the issues discussed in these podcasts also link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info. Please listen to previous conversations in the series with many other fascinating guests. But till next time, goodbye.